You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew Taylor. I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. I'm delighted to welcome you all for today's special lunchtime talk. It's my great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, David Halpin. David Halpin is the Chief Executive of the government's renowned Behavioural Insights team, which he's led since its inception in 2010. Prior to that, David was the founding director of the Institute for Government and was the chief analyst at the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit for many years. Before that, he held tenure at Cambridge and posts at Oxford and Harvard. He's written several books on behavioural insights and well-being, including Social Capital and one of my favourite books of all time, The Hidden Wealth of Nations. I've known David for many, many years in many different guises. I was saying to him earlier that when I first knew him, he was an academic, then he became a civil servant, and now he's kind of running a company. So he's gone on that whole kind of journey. Please welcome David Halpin.
Thank you. I said to Matthew, I was going to just, saving you having to read, you know, one of these big background books by Danny Kahneman or someone, but I use a piece of paper basically to illustrate the entire literature. Which I'm going to now try and do. So there are two things I'm going to talk about today, which are essentially the essence of what the Behavioural Insights team has been doing and why I think it's been very impactful, not only in the UK, but increasingly across the world. So one side of it will be introducing essentially a more realistic model of the human being into policymaking. So you've had lots of interesting people talk about this in RSA previously, but it turns out it's quite a radical idea to actually have that realistic model. And it leads to very different policy conclusions, which I'll try and show you some in a little while. The other side to it will be experimentation, which is to actually have a different kind of approach to government, which is to say, actually, you know, we really don't know what works most of the time, but we've got a great idea, which is we'll try out some alternatives and see what works. And that is itself a quietly, incredibly radical idea for government with enormous impact. Anyway, coming back to my piece of paper, if I might, if I take this piece of paper, I can tear it in half. Those who've seen this before. So I'm going to show you what people are good at and what they're not good at. And you can see, hopefully this is relevant. So I take the first bit and I scrumple it up. I'm going to need a volunteer who's going to catch it. You ready? Or someone who's very good, thank you. Oh, we're going to go behind you. Oh, perfect, it doesn't matter. So good and effective. So I say to you, how do you do that?
I put my hands up and pull it.
Sounds really easy, doesn't it? Of course, it's phenomenally complicated. If something's moving to you in space, it's actually ambiguous about where it is in space. You've got to work out how heavy it is, how fast it's moving, where is it going to be? You have to anticipate that, move your hands perfectly in sync, and then catch it, right? It seems really easy, but we can't build a computer or a robot to do that yet, right? But we take it totally for granted. Amazingly good at certain kinds of things, which you do basically without thinking. So you can tell me in outline terms, but in fact, to unpick it is quite hard. If I take the other half of this paper, though, very simple thing, I used to do this with my Cambridge students years ago, and you have to bear with me. Imagine I could fold this in half, which I've just did, and then fold it again, and then fold it again. I carry on doing that. Imagine I could, it's difficult to do it in practice, but I did that 100 times. Imagine I did that 100 times. The question is, how thick does it become? Right? What's that?
Million miles.
Million miles? You're getting sort of ish. Any other estimates? It's billions of light years. So people think, oh, it must be really thick. And students say, you know, maybe as high as the room, maybe to moon, maybe a million miles. I mean, your orders of magnitude way off. So it's roughly, if you think, not just the solar system, in fact, the entire Milky Way, about 10 times thicker than the Milky Way, or wider than. So it's billions of light years thick. It's a very simple calculation. You can do it in a few moments with a calculator. It'd be the thickness of the paper, right? And then times 2 to the power 100. We're really rubbish at it. An exponential function. Well, the world actually is full of it. Investment decisions have exponential functions in them. We don't intuitively do them. We're not very good at it. So there you go. That's the gist of what we're trying to do. And in essence, let's understand what people do well and build the world around that rather than what they don't do well. So, the background I'm just going to use is obviously for this the book, which is back out there at the moment, just come out. But it's also because I feel quite passionately that if governments are going to use these, and indeed companies out there using them, you have to be a bit open. We should be fully open about these kinds of approaches, and I'll come back to that later. So I'll just show you very briefly, short history. It's not that governments have never done this before. In fact, you guys have been nudged. You're nudged all the time. A very simple, everyday example of it is white lines in the road. This is one of the earliest white lines in the road put in Dead Man's Corner in the US in 1919. Someone had a great idea. These cars kept shooting around the corner and hitting each other. Well, how about putting this line in the middle of the road with a big arrow? You can say, go on this side, not the other. We started to do this ourselves in the UK in the early 1920s, starting in Manny Corner outside Birmingham. Turns out it's really effective. But if you think about it, for many people, including, in fact, when you and I learned to drive, the highway code was advisory. It actually is, when you're learning to drive, it's a code. It's a really good idea. Go on this side of the road rather than the other. And a lot of it still is. If you read it, some things it says you must, and some things it says you should, because it's not necessarily in law. Now, you could be done for dangerous driving, but as you can see, basically, it's full of nudges. Cat's eyes, lines on the road, they're sort of giving you a clue about what you're supposed to do, and they work pretty well. That said, it doesn't mean we use it systematically. So there's three very broad literatures in psychology which sort of feed into this area. We just quickly mention them. So one is what you might consider classic experimental or physiological type psych. So this is an illustration of, these are called Mach bands. If you ever seen them, probably have done. And if it looks, you should look shaded. They look shaded to you, right? They do look shaded. But they're not, of course. They're all exactly even in their tone. But your brain sees them as being shaded. It's an incredibly powerful illusion, but it's a really useful one. Why does that happen? It's because your brain is wired to notice differences. So, for example, if you look at someone's eyes, if you gaze into their eyes, you'll see they're moving. They move very fast. And what that's doing is if cells on a boundary, for example, are getting switched on and off, whereas some of them are just fading away and they habituate. So your brain is interested in edges, not things that are constant and don't change, right? It's very deeply rooted. And that's true. It has lots of implications in the world. So, for example, in prices, people aren't very good at telling you the absolute value of something quite often. But they're very attuned to relative values, right? So our brains are tuned into differences, basically. Another great tradition, of course, is social psychology, particularly American social psychology, and lots of wonderful experiments, most of which are now deemed completely unethical. This is a shot, of course, from Milgram, but the idea of what do real human beings do in the real world. And it turns out that they often don't do things that people thought. So in the Milgram experiment, for those who don't know it, everybody knows it, basically. You know, you're hooked up and you're told to electrocute this guy, and basically most people do it. More than two-thirds go all the way. But when people were asked, psychiatrists, well, how many people would do this under these circumstances, their estimate was less than 1% of the population who would be psychopaths, right? All wrong, because of situational forces in this case. And the other tradition is like Danny Kahneman's stuff, which I just showed you an example of, which is mental heuristics, the mental shortcuts that people use, which has turned out to be incredibly powerful. So anyway, these three traditions are telling us a lot about human beings, and they are quite different from a lot of the models which we use in policy, the idea that you'll pass a law and somehow people's behaviour will change, you know, or that classical economics is right, which is sometimes, but often is not. So, we have had goes at this before. I just thought partly for Matthew here, I would just remind him of, I think it must have been just before you came into number 10, but we, back in the days when we had the strategy unit with Tony Blair, we did this paper, 2004, you can see, on personal responsibility and changing behaviour, the state of knowledge and its implications for public policy, which wasn't very snappy, it's true. It also had on it, every page, this is an issue paper for discussion purposes and does not represent government policy. Anyway, when it ended up on the front page of the Times the morning of launch, that wasn't a view they'd taken. And in particular, as it was picked up, here's the BBC. We had a one-line reference, so, you know, just a bit of a discussion around how do prices, when do prices affect your behaviour and when do they not, and would they, you know, affect it. Still controversial today, of course. I won't go through all the headlines. You can imagine how it kind of went. Actually, one of my favourite, I haven't put it up, was... I think it was the Mail who had pictures of the cabinet with an estimate, how much fat tax will Prezza pay? And it had underneath each of them their weight. But anyway, the point about it is that we now take it a bit for granted in this moment that all behavioural stuff actually does make sense. But it's not at all necessarily intuitive. And people do have some quite strong reactions to the idea of governments thinking about behaviour and trying to affect it directly. So yes, obviously Tony then subsequently said, of course, we'd never do any of that kind of stuff. Come along coalition government, a very different time, I think that matters, where the government is trying, you know, essentially generally deregulatory and it's in times of austerity, reducing the size of state. It felt much easier, I think, in 2010 to revisit this sort of idea and approach. And hence in the coalition agreement, this clause and phrase, which in some ways then was the raison d'etre of the behavioural insight team, the nudge unit, as everyone came to call it. So, okay, detail, but these kind of people in particular were important. The PM, we had support from the then Cabinet Secretary, Gough, who then moved on to our advisory board, and then Jeremy Hayward in terms of the Cabinet Secretary. So we have a steering group from chaired by the Cabinet Secretary. So a pretty direct line. But we're seven people back then. This is from about 2 weeks ago. We had the big event in London and the team now. So there's about 65 people working across a number of governments. So how did we get there in between? So let me just show you a bit of that. So the most basic thing is these very simple nuts and bolts changes, which turn out to be very consequential. And I'll just show you a few of them. And using a very simple framework, we sometimes use EAST. If you want to affect behavior, make something easier, attractive, social, timely. I'll just give you a very simple example on the first, which illustrates it, because people think, well, maybe it would affect whether I pay my tax on time or something. But an example from British history, our recent history, is suicide rates. So some of you might know that the suicide rate in Britain started dropping in the late 1950s. People didn't notice it, first of all, thought it was fluctuation. It fell year on year for 7 years in a row for both men and women, quite dramatically. It fell by about 25, nearly 30%. Some of you know why that happened?
Gas.
It was gas, exactly. So it was gas. It used to be people killed themselves by putting their head in the oven. What happened? North Sea oil is discovered. It's got less carbon monoxide. It actually doesn't work to put your head in the oven anymore. This is a pretty major life event to decide whether to kill yourself or not. But it turns out that adding in a little bit of extra fiction, making it more difficult, leads to a permanent reduction in the suicide rate, which never went back up again. So it's not just trivial matters. Very big matters are affected too. So auto-enrollment, I won't go through detail, but this is a very early cut of data. In fact, we now have the first firms who joined. Since 2012, more than 5 million people are saving above what would have been before as a result of auto-enrollment. A simple change, instead of having to opt in, you have to opt out. It turns out it wasn't Anglo-Saxons hated saving, we just couldn't be bothered to fill in a form to tell someone to do this thing. Particularly affected low-income groups and the young. Huge effect. I mean, what some people don't know is it's worth juxtaposing. So that's amazing. It's more than 90% actually of people who are eligible stay in and they opt in, right? What's the conventional policy tool we use? A tax subsidy. What's the effectiveness of a tax subsidy? For £1 of extra tax subsidy on the table to get you to save, it leads to, our best estimate is 1p of extra saving on average across population. As opposed to changing the default, 91% stay in. Amazingly big difference. Other examples. This is a famous one. I'll just flip through it. Maybe an early one was important. Just changing a tax letter. Adding one line saying, 9 out of 10 people pay their tax on time. Does this. Say, most people in your area pay their tax on time. Goes up a bit more. If we say, you are one of the few people who have yet to pay your tax on time, madam. Even better. And if we say, most people in your area pay their tax on time, and you're one of the few yet to do so, you're up there. This is for one line on a letter. You can get a difference like this in terms of repayment rate. So you can see, as particularly PermSex as heads of departments who might have been sceptical about the general idea, I'm not dumb to realise the significance of something like this. It can be playful. Here's one from Australia, actually, where I have to go shortly in the next week or two, which is just get people to take the stairs more in Southern Cross Station. They just put a big picture on it. Led to a more than 100% increase in the number of people taking the stairs. They kept it there for a month. There is a really sad end to the story, actually. It's so effective. Of course, it was then bought as an advertising space for a large drinks manufacturer. Anyway, still, it illustrates the point about attractive and how can you catch people's attention matters. Here's one which my colleague on the political side, Steve Hilton, also used to love, which is, it's not just these things are effective, they have a different character to them sometimes. So this is some work we did in job centres, getting people to turn up. We noticed that quite often someone we booked in, so Matthew's in for a job or whatever next week, and it turns out that we know that you send them a text to say, Matthew, it would be a text, it would say, you've been booked a place for this job interview at Tesco's or whatever for the weekend, it's job fair. Only 1 in 10 people turn up, all right? If we add a name, so it says Matthew, you've been booked a place, it's on the same text. If I add my name, so it's Matthew, you've been booked a place, David, this is how many turn up. And if we add one more line, which is to say, Matthew, I've booked you a place, blah, 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 good luck, David, 27% turn up. So not just that, of course, it's more effective, but think about how do you feel receiving that text and how do you feel when you walk into the interview, feeling that actually someone has done this for you. If there's good lab evidence to suggest, you're more likely to get the job, in essence. Okay, this is a recent one, which I think is amazing, and it's illustration into this world where one way you can think about this stuff is that, particularly if you've got teenage kids, you might think, I bet there's the right thing to say here, and I don't know what it is, and I'm probably going to say the wrong thing. Well, here's a glimpse into it. So one problem we were wrestling with was lack of, or a big difference between ethnic groups and the success rates joining the police. Right? It's quite a well-rehearsed issue. Because it was such a big difference in many areas, the Home Office actually took a key part of the exam called the Situational Judgment Test and turned it into an online exam. Right? So it's not even marked by a human being. And yet, let me show you, these are the results. So there's the white population, their marks. There's the ethnic minorities. It's on an online exam. So a lot of discussion about why this must be. It must be mastery of English, for example, or various other, often unrepeatable, frankly, explanations that might be going on here. So he said, can we just make one change? We just want to add one little tiny line when people receive the email. So you imagine you get this email, and it's going to say to you, it's time to do this exam. So what we do is we just say, at this one line, it says, before you do this test, just take a few moments to think about why was it important to you and your community to join the police. It's only difference. Only difference. So this is a randomized controlled trial. We split into two. That's what happens. That's the white population, see, unaffected. That's the scores for the BMEs. And if we look at the pass rate here was 60%, and over here was 40%. This difference is enough, essentially, to create the pass rates coming to the same point, 60 and 60. It's quite astonishing when you think about how important that is. And it's true for many areas, the way we give feedback to kids in a classroom and so on. You can inadvertently put someone down a trajectory without realizing that's what you're doing. I'm going to move up a gear now, really. And so there are loads and loads of these nuts and bolts examples, and they are very, very powerful, and they help to persuade a lot of skeptics about it. But you can also, I think it takes you to, actually Matthew's talked about this in other ways, it has a more profound challenge about how you think about human beings and takes you to different policy solutions. So some can be even in the job centre, instead of just changing message, you want to change the behaviour of the advisor. So we changed it made a few changes, but a key one was, instead of saying what we've done in the last 30 years, called active welfare policy, because basically governments don't trust people a lot, and so you have to prove that you're looking for work. So you turn up in front of the advisor and they say, you've got to show which of the three jobs you looked for last week, right? And that's where you've got to come in with a bit of paper. So they said, forget that. Let's ask about what you're going to do next week instead. And we use what's called implementation intention. So if I can pick on Matthew again, I say, that job you're going for, I know you're really busy at the moment, you've got this thing in the RSA or whatever, but let's think about next week. What kind of work are you looking for?
Me?
Yeah, yeah.
I'd like to play for West Brom.
West Brom, very good. Please say, is there anything else you think of? Anyway, so we'd say, okay, let's think about how are you going to go about that? How are you going to go about it?
I'm going to practice.
You're going to practice? Okay, but you're going to find that advertised in the paper? No, you're not. How are you going to you're going to have to call up some friends in West Brom, whatever. And then you can say, okay, so fine, that's a bit more of a... And when are you going to do this? Because you're quite busy next week. Let's think about next week. When are you going to call them up? Yeah, you get the gist of it. You can say, well, on Wednesday afternoon, because I know a bit of time there. So you ask people to say what, when, how, etc. Does it make a difference? It makes a big difference. There's control group. There's changing this mechanism around in terms of the number of people off benefits at 13 weeks. And then we strip out everything we can and so on. This is now national policy. You can go to any job centre. Advisors will do this in a different way. We've also replicated this in other countries with even bigger effects, getting sick workers back to work faster and so on. But it's not just a message, because you have to change the behaviour of the advisor too, is what I guess I'm trying to say. It takes you to different kinds of solutions about markets. So this is one in relation to energy markets, which has been a pretty big political issue the last few years, involving often, well, shall you reduce the number of tariffs? This has happened, or Ed Miliband said cap them. How many people in the room have changed your electricity supplier or gas in the last year? Can I just ask a few of you? Actually, quite a few of you. That's very good. Disproportionate numbers, maybe. But still, maybe 15%. But for the rest of you, so why haven't you? You save hundreds of pounds. Why haven't you got around to it? You didn't put your hand up, sir, I think.
Inertia,
right. You're busy. It's also a pain in the arse if you try and make the change. So I remember I had to talk to the PM about this, and I thought, weekend before, I'll switch, because I haven't done it either. I spent a while doing it, and I failed to do so. Because it turns out I need a number, which the number on the bill is not the right one. I have to call up British Gas and get the number I do need. Anyway, now skeptics might think maybe the gas company is doing this to make it more difficult. Well, what can you do? Well, we introduce a clause called My Data, which means that when you get your bill now, you should see on it a QR code which summarizes your data. Why is that important? Because you can put a smartphone against it and it will say in a few seconds, actually, the best tariff for you would be the following. Would you like to switch? Right? So now instead of it being inertia, it's difficult. Actually, you literally could do this in a few seconds. It's funny, we tried to do this on a voluntary basis for a few years with the utility companies, and it turned out, after they thought about it, they weren't so keen, so we did have to legislate. But you can see why it's a game changer. But from a classical point of view, it doesn't matter, right? Because frictional factors don't matter. You should be rational, you'll figure it out. But of course, they matter a huge amount. But it takes you to a different kind of solution as a regulator or as a government in terms of if you want to make a market, you believe in a market, you have to figure out how it really works and how you might make it work better. Here's another example. So quite a controversial one in many countries, which is getting people to quit smoking and particularly the role of e-cigarettes. So we took a view, contrary to many of those in the public health community, which that e-cigarettes are probably a good thing rather than a bad thing. Because if you want someone to stop an addictive behaviour, it's generally easier, rather than getting them to stop, to switch to something else. So this was very controversial. Many other countries have gone a very different way, but these are quit attempts. And this is the primary route now for quits in the UK are e-cigarettes, and they are more effective than alternatives as well. So if you do a slightly interesting thing, which you say, what would we pay for a drug that would save as many lives as e-cigarettes appear to do if you model them? It is billions. It's literally billions. But the irony is, in many countries, not least often driven by the public health professionals, have felt that what we should do is ban e-cigarettes. So it takes you to a different kind of solution. This one I thought I'd just partly as a Matthew tribute, but we used to call this Big Society once upon a time, but the idea that people have a very strong desire to reciprocate, and I still think it's striking in an area where we've made less progress, but why don't we ask things? So instead of going to when you go to your medical appointment and seeing a notice like this, why isn't it more like a patient hotel where in Sweden, as they're called, part of the hospital, where there are always two beds and you're encouraged to stay with your partner, your child. You get, of course, higher patient satisfaction, lower costs, and you get better clinical outcomes as well. But we don't design our services in ways to make those ask. So when you're going back to the job centre, the key issue is getting a job, particularly for the unemployed, is they don't know people in employment in that area. They've got poor, weak ties. Well, why don't job centres ask people who've now got a job, really pleased for that, would you be happy to talk to someone in 6 months' time who's looking for a job in that kind of area? Most people would say yes and feel good about it, but we don't build systems to do that. Well, not much anyway. The last thing I just mentioned, at least in passing, is a lot of people who think about these behavioural effects also get interested in well-being, and that's because we use the same mental apparatus to make decisions around big issues in life, about where we live and do we commute and who do we marry. And it looks like we don't do it very perfectly. I mean, it's Danny Gilbert, Stumbling on Happiness, has put it. Humans have got this incredible capacity to be time travellers, right? We can literally go back in time and think about what happened when we were on holiday or also into the future. What would it be like if, right? It's amazing, actually. It just turns out we're not as good at it as we think we are. So we are systematically misremember and also mispredict. So, you know, there's the UK, I should say. We think there's very interesting stuff around essentially what you might call deshrouding, helping people make better decisions about what will make them happy or not. Not for us to make the decision, but enable people to make better decisions. And people interested in behavioural literature often get drawn into this quite a wide, I think, profound issue. So just kind of last section, really, where next? Where do we go to with all this? So, people thought it was kind of funny in 2010, bit of a joke, the nudge unit. And interestingly, I think if it had been a bigger operation, we probably would have stumbled. But with a very small skunk work, there was enough time. We set it up with a sunset clause so that if it didn't work, it would be shut down by default in 2 years, if it didn't, for example, achieve at least tenfold return on the cost of the unit. But as those sort of results came in, people responded, certainly inside Whitehall and beyond, in quite positive ways. Even Steve Hilton got a good headline, I remember. It's since spread across the world. I mean, these are just some of the places we know and or involved in doing work. And indeed, some of you who follow this might have seen just, I think, last week, 10 days ago, the White House put out its first year of results in its version of the Nudge Unit, which is basically based on what we've been doing. Even in other places, we got asked by the World Bank, for example, to help in Guatemala using some of those results on tax. So Guatemala has euphemistically called very low tax morale. it's a wonderful phrase. But we were really doubtful about, would this stuff which worked, you know, in HMRC and, you know, leafy bits of Britain to get people to pay their tax, would it work in Guatemala? Well, I'll just show you the results from a trial. That's a control letter. This is basically, they get a letter and they're asked, you know, you haven't paid your tax on such and such. And this is the amount of dollars that come back in response, right? So we're tracking an actual hard outcome. So there's the original letter. They sent out a letter. Many letters from governments turn out to be quite difficult people to understand, it turns out. So rewriting it in, actually in this case, in plain Spanish, but that actually helps quite a lot. People can understand what you've asked them. Here, making reference to national pride. It's important for the nation. That helps a bit. Here, social norms. Now, actually, it's worth pausing for a minute, because we couldn't say in Guatemala 9 out of 10 people pay their tax on time. But we were able to identify this particular tax, which 62% of people did eventually pay. So we put this stat in, and in Guatemala, people were like, oh, my God, really? So there's a general effect, by the way. People systematically underestimate the virtue of their fellow citizens and particularly overestimate the number of bad things everybody else does. So that works really well. And the other thing is something which almost exactly the same as worked in one of the UK variations, which is to say, because people basically, most people, even you probably, cheat a little bit. They cheat a little bit. They don't want to cheat very much. And that's generally, and they don't like to overtly cheat. So if you get to a tax bit of a tax form and it says, please declare other income, right? Well, a lot of people, it turns out, skip over that question. But if you had to write something, but you could write nil, but you have to write something, loads of people who would have skipped over it now start writing in, actually, there was $100 or £100, whatever it is. So basically, that's what we're doing, a crystallizing. You know, you might have missed it before, sorry, could have got buried, but we'll kind of assume now it's a deliberate choice, even more effective. So these are really big differences in terms of what seems like a small... I mean, getting people to pay their taxes turns out to be rather important for governments. A last one on tax, but it's also to make a more general point, which is one of the ways these are evolving, which you might want to think about, how do you feel about this, is personalised messages. So even on tax. So I showed you that early, actually now quite famous example on, you know, most people pay their tax on time, and you know, you haven't got around to doing it. It works on 95% of the population. It's an amazingly powerful general effect. It was just too bad. There was 5% of the population on whom it didn't work, who are the people with the biggest tax debts, especially the top 1% who owe more than £30,000. And when they get this letter saying most people pay their tax on time, they are actually less likely to pay than they would if you hadn't said anything to them at all. They might be like, well, I'm really not most people. So the question is, could you work out a message to work? So we would do that. So here's one, which is really nice. Actually, particularly if you're on the left, you might think about it, is... saying to people, it's really important you pay your taxes because they pay for schools and hospitals, basically, and if you don't, we can't pay for them. Sadly, that doesn't work for most people, that message. That's the general population. But for this top 1%, it has huge impacts, right? And particularly when you word it in terms of loss. So if you don't pay, we can't do the following. And in fact, the difference between this message and the other one for this group is almost a doubling in the proportion who pay. So it can be very powerful, but you also want to think about how do you feel about the government's going to figure out who you are and give you a message just for you? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? So finally, to conclusion, really getting there now, you can use this in very nuts and bolts issues, which might not seem very exciting, but governments are neglectful of these and they turn out to be really, really important. You can use it for, takes you to actually fundamentally different kinds of conclusions, and you can even get you to think about well-being and different kinds of objectives. The last thing I wanted to return to, last, is even if you don't care about the behavioural stuff, I want to return to this point I mentioned at the beginning, which is the use of government experiments. Government by experiment is a profound development with enormous implications. Use of randomised controlled trials and what we call what works centres. So let me just briefly, lastly, mention this. I think it's last. So we've had NICE since 1999. And when you go to your doctor and they say, you know, you or your kid should have the following pills, you have some real grounds to think they didn't just make it up. They didn't just say, you know what, Smarties today, that'd be all right. There was some evidence base behind it, literally hundreds of thousands of trials. That is not true for most public service professions, and it is not true for most areas of government policy. We often don't know what works. We don't know whether we're doing something that's even effective at all quite often. So the idea is that why don't we, systematically test. So in recent years, a whole host of these new institutions, Educational Endowment Fund, doing experiments in schools, literally experiments, more than 100 large-scale experiments in the last few years, involving more than 500,000 kids and 5,000 schools, but also early intervention, local growth, crime, even better ageing. It's really radical. And their kind of output is stuff like this. This is what you'd see if you went to the Educational Endowment Fund site. You see lists of different kinds of things. There's an estimate of, well, you know, how big is the impact in terms of months of advance or not for the child? How much do they cost generally for a class? And how confident are we of the evidence? And it turns out lots of things we thought were important, like school uniforms, generally don't make much difference. As opposed to, actually you'll love it, if you heard it, teaching kids an hour of philosophy a week turns out to boost their performance on maths, writing and reading by an average 3 months at age 11. Forget their philosophy skills, right? But we can figure that out by actually testing it. So one, you know, future for the, is this nudge stuff? Is it, this is UCL, but of course, Orwell, is it, you know, Ministry of Information, 1984, very scary? Well, it could be, or we could use it well. And it's rather important, I think, myself, that we involve the public. And the last thing I think for it is, for us, is do you move from these nuts and bolts issues, for many governments now using these things, is what about the really big challenges that face a society? Almost always they involve human behaviour and so on. It can be about how markets operate for consumers, right? Particularly in an electronic and e-world, right? Incredibly sensitive to these sorts of things. In terms of climate change, right? It's about human behaviour. What can you do to change people's behaviour? Or in relation to obesity, pretty big issue still. Or what's happening in a classroom or in a home, or issues of trust in markets. If you think about some of the biggest issues about driving growth are so-called animal spirits. They're about what you think other people are doing, essentially by psychological facts. But also conflicts occurring across the world and so on. I mean, it ought to be that psychology and behavioural insights has something to say for these big issues. And if it's the case that, you know, economics and a lot of essentially prior assumptions about many of our political models were wrong in their core heartland, right, and we can get these better results, then why aren't we applying it more generally? And I think, for me, that's one of the key challenges in the years to come. So thank you. I've probably taken too long, but I hope you give some sense of what we've been doing.
David, that was fantastic. So as I've often felt when I've heard you talk about this work, I feel a combination of feeling inspired and irritated. Inspired because it's so brilliant, but irritated because I seem to have spent so much of my time working on models of change, which seem so much less impressive than your kind of very clever, very nuanced interventions. So just to help me and help us, can you tell us something that failed?
Yeah.
Just something where you got it completely wrong and you made a fool of yourself.
I'm happy. We have quite a selection of them. And by the way, it's a rather important question on lots of levels, because if you want to, especially to go down the experimental approach, you have to accept that's what you're going to find. You're going to find some things that don't work. And that's got to be normal. So, yes, but I will absolutely enter into the spirit of it. There are lots of examples where we did something on organ donation. I sometimes put it up as an example, where one of the variants was adding an image. And it turned out that adding an image of healthy, happy people alongside organ donation made people less likely to join the register. It's often true for images, actually. Images often have these quite complex effects because they're laden with other kinds of meaning. Another recent example in that space is that, based actually on lab work from a UK university, if you saw a picture of your house in infrared where you could see all the heat leaking out, then maybe you'd be more likely to insulate, which seemed a really good idea. So we ran a big trial on it. It turned out people were less likely generally to do so. But it may be because they're distracted by it in some other way. So these might seem trivial ones, but they are very real.
Is that to do, are both those examples related to something we know about public health, which is it doesn't work to have pictures of Paula Radcliffe or David Beckham because it just makes people feel that's completely beyond their attainment. I can never be as good as that, so why should I even bother? And is it the same if you see all this heat coming out of your house, you think, well, my whole house is leaking heat. What's the point of putting a few bits of rug up in the attic?
Well, it could be. I mean, one thing to bear in mind about one of the criticisms of particularly randomised controlled trials is that they don't necessarily tell you why. They tell you this worked and this didn't, but then you have to then figure out why it is. Of course, you can try and get some clues by doing other variations, which do give you a clue. But, I mean, there are lots of images that do work. So, famously, the work of Slovak, which has shown that, you know, if you want, as we've recently seen, of course, If you want to get everybody to worry and give lots of money to some disaster, don't give statistics. Don't give a picture of lots of things. A picture of a single child. A single child is much, much more effective. Interestingly, a lot of people thought, well, why don't we have the picture of the child and the stats? That is still less effective than just the child, by quite a big margin. So a lot of things we have emotional reactions to. Or another one why you might want to use images is that there's a famous study showing if you add a picture of an attractive woman to offers of credit, people will pay a lot more for it. Again, by quite particularly men, it turns out. So they can be very powerful. And we have had examples where they worked. I'll give you one more, which is we did on people who hadn't paid their car tax and who persistently hadn't. And it turns out we know this in the UK because you get picked up on, just in case you might want to know, you get picked up on the camera. We have lots of cameras, of course, right along. So we thought, well, why don't we just try including in the letter the picture of the camera, of the car. And of course, that leads to about a 20% boost in the number of people who pay. Someone from France told me that they were doing this a few years before us, which was very interesting, and they had to stop doing it because you could often see who's in the car. So I think the funny thing is, of course, the logical thing is to say, well, we won't send the picture as long as you pay. Which is the way to go.
If you'd spent more time on the history of this, I suspect one of the people you might have quoted would have been Vance Packard and Hidden Persuaders, because of course, in a sense, the private sector was onto these subliminal ways of influencing what we do, way ahead of government, and they're not laboured by Daily Mail headlines and mechanisms of accountability. They can just go on and do it. I'm interested in what your work has led you to feel about how the private sector uses this stuff and whether it uses it responsibly or irresponsibly and whether or not there's a kind of regulatory deficit in terms of you seeing the private sector doing stuff which isn't currently, isn't in any way kind of constrained.
I do feel quite strongly, and those of you who've read it, there's still a wonderful book by Robert Chialdini, who you might remember we had in Downing Street back in 2006. So, and he was fascinated by these issues. That was originally his motivation about, you know, almost tricksters and these kind of techniques in the trade, how they worked. And one reason why I mentioned is that governments are drawn into this even if they don't want to use it themselves, because they need to understand how they are being used on citizens. Like an intelligent regulator needs to understand that. If you are Ofgem, you need to understand, well, what is happening on your energy bills and what's an effective strategy. I personally think many regulators should be much more assertive about this. And so if you're a government that believes in markets, you need to have a sophisticated account of how market really does operate and be there on the side of citizens. I mean, that is happening on all kinds of weird, you know, a lot of well-known. Like, if you're, depending on the kind of computer you're using, maybe charge a different tariff or a price, or the time of day that you're logging on, because it tells you something about who you are and how much you can afford to pay. And in direct marketing, over very long periods of time, people have experimented with different kinds of messages. There's something to be learned from them, but also I totally agree. It's something about, well, how do we feel as citizens? How do we want to? You want someone on your side who's making sure that's being broadly used for good as opposed for bad. And there's lots of ways in which this stuff can be used abusively. It's definitely dangerous.
Which takes me on to my third question. I've got two more questions before we open it up. I'm not going to go through all the kind of conventional criticisms of this, partly because you've referred to them, you know, that it's overbearing and paternalistic on the one hand. Or there's another kind of critique that Evgeny Morozov and others have kind of articulated, which is this drives one to thinking that the nature of all problems is they're about individual frailties rather than power structures and class and these kinds of things. Yeah. Rather than responding to those, I'm kind of interested, when you go around the world and people are enthusiastic advocates for your approach, are there times when you wince? Are there times when you think, no, hang on, that's going too far, that's taking it too far, we need to bring it back and put it in context?
Well, I think there are some examples where it tells you, to me, because we use the phrase nudge unit because everybody uses it, but it is essentially trying to introduce a more realistic model of human behaviour. But sometimes that will tell you a nudge is not enough. So I do think it can help on some issues, for example, on climate issues. But fundamentally, it tells you why you are going to have to do some quite heavy lifting conventional tools, because most people will never worry about a distant future on which they can have relatively limited leverage right now, and it'll just get worse. So all the behavioural forces are working against you And so governments need to step up. You do sometimes get, look, we often get shown things, or I see, or even a minister will say, oh, I really need to see you did that such and such. And you look and you think, well, we definitely didn't do that one. But in some ways that's good because you want to see it adopted in the public sector. But you do, of course, sometimes see examples where you just think, oh, really? There was one, I know we're on camera, so I have to be a bit careful. But with HMRC, we were discussing the evidence, the revenue service, on eyes. You know, sort of this famous result, which is that you can try it at home or in canteens, which is that different pictures on the wall affect whether you're honest or not. So it was done in relation to honesty boxes, where if you have some eyes, a picture of a face, people are much more likely to put money in the box than if it's a neutral picture. It's true also, by the way, even if whether you pick up your tray in a canteen, if you have a nice picture of flowers and a message saying, you know, please take your tray away, it doesn't do a thing. If you have a picture of a face looking at you, people are much more likely to clear their tray away. Anyway, so we were talking to HMRC about this, you know, as you do, about, and they got very excited about it. And then, of course, you may remember, they'd run a big campaign everywhere. These eyes on the underground, everywhere, like, peering out, like, we're watching you, thinking, 1984, is that a little bit problematic? So that was, you know, definitely close to the wince territory.
The nudge unit is the Behavior Insights team, is part of a panoply, actually, of different ways of thinking about policy making, which have come out of the Cabinet Office. There's open policy making, there's a kind of focus on service design. We've got Andrew Sjodmark speaking here quite soon, Weaving Her a Prize, who runs the design lab. As you see these innovations in government, is this an interesting time in terms overall, in terms of government experimentation, do you think? And what are the biggest barriers to that, and to kind of lead you in a particular direction? Forms of accountability, parliamentary accountability, seem very badly suited to this kind of experiment, try it out, fail, try it out again approach.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I do think there are, on the experimentation side, we shouldn't, I don't know how people feel about it in the room, but a lot of people feel uncomfortable with it because there are competing principles, by the way, if I'll come back to your main point, about fairness, and everybody should be treated the same. It's quite hard to run an experimental approach where you do that. But there are governments that, for example, Germans, so Merkel set up her own behavioral insight team now. And we show them some of the results. They're incredibly interested. Merkel personally was interested in them. But then they're like, oh, but we have a problem. Because like, we're saying it's quite easy to do this. Well, they said, well, we can't change a letter and do a variation because it will be like an experiment on humans, and we're constitutionally not allowed to do experiments on human beings. And we'd have to go to Parliament to get a request to change this thing. But in terms of accountability, remember, what's the background to it? We spend billions and billions and do all kinds of things in professional life at XYZ against a backdrop, remember, of overconfidence. We all think what we're doing is good and helpful and must be having positive effects. We don't know. And when we have tested stuff occasionally, it's turned out to be, often it's literally killing people. I mean, the steroids, I don't know if you heard the one on injections, for if you had a head injury, if you've done this one. Anyway, but...
Tell people. People always remember disasters more than they remember successes.
Yeah, that's true. So even in medicine, where we think it was being very evidence-based, you know, there are examples. Medics sometimes use as a response, is sometimes you shouldn't do an experiment because it'd be unethical, and they use what's called the parachute test. Right. So we don't do randomized controlled trials on parachutes. We'll take half of you on a plane, and you'll get parachutes and jump out, and you jump out without, right? Because it's obvious what the result's going to be. And so this is often used to say, it would be unethical, it would be wrong, you know, to do a trial. So a famous example a couple of years ago was, for years, if you have a head injury, you go into A&E, you get a steroid injection. Because a head injury leads to swelling. Steroids reduce swelling, generally speaking. So that's what happens. And it was considered unethical to do a trial. When trials, in fact, two large trials were done, they showed that injections of steroids make you more likely to die. So we've literally been killing people for years. And that's in medicine. Now you think about all the other things. Think about the $5 billion we spend on social work or on policing or the billions that flow out to simulate economic growth. And you say, in terms of accountability, there's accountability. Like, did you spend the money in the local area or did you spend it on a Ferrari for yourself? We're quite good at that. Did it work? Did it actually boost growth, employment, etc.? Most of the time, we have no idea. I hope, actually, our kids will look at it and, like, what were you thinking? Like,
so going back to my first question, given that you sat at the Institute for Government, across the world, do you think this is a good time for governments to be learning that they have to do things in quite radically different ways?
Well, is it a good time? It is happening now. I mean, I can almost go back to the, like, why the hell weren't we doing it before? There is something particular about British government which makes it well suited to some of these things, which is that you may remember from your time in Downing Street, nothing's bolted down really constitutionally. So you can get a new prime minister coming in and just say, oh, well, let's try the following thing. So it's quite good at trying things out. It's not very good at systematically figuring out did they work and then shutting down the things that didn't work. I think there are some forces which are possibly helping this. So digital. Digital makes it easier. Digital lowers by orders of magnitude the cost and effort involved in doing trials and variations. Anything which disrupts an institution or behaviour also creates an opportunity to make a change. So any disruption, but there are always many of those. There's a lot more stuff on design thinking. People see in other parts of their life, that's true. Again, I think a lot of these things, in retrospect, we'll think, why the hell weren't we doing it before? And there's a half full and a half empty. So people are a lot interested in the nudge unit, its effects and so on. And there are lots of great results. But I'm also acutely aware myself, and we are just scratching the surface. You know, just take a simple thing like health, public health. Well, more than 3/4 of years of healthy life lost are to behavioural factors, smoking, diet, you know, blah, blah, blah. Is that where we spend our money? Is that where we spend our effort? Is that what we're doing? Even our billions, which we spend on research, we're not spending on those things for the most part. Right? We're spending it on more drugs or drug trials or yet another fMRI. You know, so I feel like it is a good time in lots of ways, certainly for this. Governments seem open to it, and austerity probably has helped. But on the other hand, institutions and indeed people are incredibly strongly prone to fixate on the way they've always done it. So I think I'd love to live in a world where people are saying, oh, my God, you're doing too many experiments. Like, really? Long way from that.
Thanks. David, you've given some great examples of how this has developed in Britain and is now influencing countries overseas.
Yes.
Are there things that other country governments are doing overseas which in turn you're thinking, hey, this is actually taking things further in an interesting way, you'd like to apply it here?
Great, hold on to that, and then we'll take these two hands here.
Do you think the behavioural insights approach could be applied to bigger problems such as attitudes to immigration, for example? Many people think that the immigrant population in the UK is 30% when it's nearer 13%.
Councils spend millions of pounds collecting litter. Have you done any work to try and persuade people not to drop litter?
Three really good punchy questions, yeah. David. Deal with those in 2 minutes and we can take another lot.
Very good. Hi, Sally. It's nice to see you. Yeah, litter. Chialdini, who did a fantastic book, his original work was on litter. He spent, that was, you know, might seem an unpromising area to work in, but it turns out incredibly interesting. So there's loads of work on litter. We've done stuff. Also, we get letters occasionally from local councils and others. And there's some guy, I can't remember who he is, but he's done lots of stuff on, well, dog shit, actually, about how to get people to pick it up and trying different messages and so on. So it turns out to be a very rich area with lots of experience. The main point is we're incredibly influenced by what other people are doing. So you come back to your car and there's a flyer on it. This is a true experiment. Do you drop it on the ground or not? You are eight times more likely to throw it on the ground if there are already a number of those flyers on the ground already, right? So, yes, it's a very rich, interesting area. It also, I just quickly...
So what do you do then? But in your tax thing, you can say to people whether or not it's true. Oh, no, you never, would never tell a lie. 60% of people do this already. But if you're in Lambeth and it's loads of litter everywhere, you can't say most people don't drop the litter because demonstrably it's untrue. So where do you start from?
Well, one of the simple lessons is, you know, generally you want to keep your environments clean because it's self-propagating. There's interesting spin-off effects, by the way. When you see a norm that's been broken... If it's actually broken windows, essentially, but now being shown to be true, it also makes you more likely to break other rules. You get spillover effects in very interesting ways. So if you have litter on the ground and a sign saying no littering, if this is a child from the Netherlands, there's a letterbox and there's an envelope that's not quite in, and you can just see there's a €5 note in it.
You're going to have to grab...
Anyway, whatever. You'll have to grab... There's lots of stuff. On the other ones...
Yeah, refugee crisis, immigration...
Yeah, I mean, there's a more general thing which you alluded to, which I mentioned also, which is that we are prone to a very strong, and it's cross-national effect, systematic bias to think worse of other people than they are. So Ipsos Mori recently just did some, put out some data on it, coinciding with our conference, actually. Similar things. How many people do you think take a sickie, right? Well, people's estimates is about 50%, whereas the actual accurate number is probably 15%. Do you think people cheat on their taxes in the UK? 36% of people think others cheat on taxes, where it's maybe, well, it depends how you work it out, but 5-10%, you know, measure. So the same is true. We think badly of each other, and that I'm sure is true in relation to immigration. I mean, on the one hand, there are nuts and bolts issues about encouraging people when they finish their study to go back rather than waiting and whatever. I think there is a bigger issue, clearly is being rehearsed cross-nationally about. I mentioned, in general, you're trying best to try and displace behaviour rather than stop it. I feel, it's a personal view, not unique, that we could do a lot more in refugee camps and elsewhere, that there be an attractive and appealing alternative, which we've not done well. So, yes, look, it's a key issue, so it's something we do need to think about.
And what have you learnt from your own travels?
So, interesting, there are some things which end up on the cutting room floor in Whitehall, which I don't really want to list all of, but for an example in broad terms, is in the private sector, often people would use, instead of conventional financial instruments, they'd use lottery-type mechanisms. So, you know, we fine you, well, actually, we just stopped fining you, but £100 if you're late paying your tax. But we don't do anything nice when you put it in on time. Why don't we say, oh, very good, we'll put you into a lottery for, you know, whatever, or we want to insulate your home. So there are lots of other kinds of incentives that can be used, which in general ministers in Britain have not wanted to use, which is fair enough, actually, for lots of reasons. But then other countries, they're like, oh, yeah, we'll do that. So we have quite a few examples. We work, say, in Singapore, an incredibly high-performing administration. And when we did a similar version of thing to get people back to work faster, I mean, we got a few percentage point increase in the UK. The trial in Singapore led to, it was a huge effect. It was like 40% increase in the number who were back at work after 13 weeks or 3 months. So we do see these examples elsewhere, and you can pull them back. I could give you a long list, but I mean, maybe I shouldn't try and do that.
In other parts of the world, I mean, I think when it comes to kind of service design, for example, we would look to Scandinavia as often being kind of in the lead in that area. Okay, let's take another round of questions. A gentleman there, first of all.
A fairly powerful message. But how sustainable these changes are, these improvements are? Because maybe it is simply, as you pointed out, that we react to new. We react positively to new. Could it be simply that it's because we are doing that? Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, good question. Right at the back, yeah.
You mentioned very briefly about effects on well-being and behavioural insights. I wondered if you could expand or have any projects that have had notable increases in life satisfaction.
You mentioned that we don't always know how or why things are going to work, thus the experimentation. And also on Wikipedia, I think there are about 164 different types of bias, whatever, to do with behavioural economics. I wondered if there was any kind of unifying idea that kind of brings, a scientific-based idea that kind of brings all this together. Is it evolutionary biology, neurology? Are we making sense of all this, all these different kind of behavioural principles?
Great. Okay, so does it sustain?
Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Of course, we can't know because we haven't done trials long enough in some areas. But there is a general pattern. It's worth bearing in mind, sometimes it doesn't need to sustain because it's a one-off change. So if you want someone to insulate their home, actually you don't need them to keep doing it every day. You just need them to do it once, right? Or, as it happens, saving for a pension tends to be very sticky. So so sometimes they don't need to be sustainable. But there are other examples where it fades out. One way of thinking about it is, does the person want to do this? This is one of the things that I think helps address some of the potentially worrying elements, is that you can generally nudge people to do things that they want to do anyway. So most people do want to save, and so it works. If you try and push some of those interventions too far, you start getting people opting out in large numbers. But I'll give you a very simple example of one where you can see where it doesn't work. We did some trials on getting people to give more money to charity. So PM was very interested in it. And one of them involved, in fact, we did a series of more than 1 year, of getting investment bankers to give a day of their salary to charity, which turns out to be quite a lot of money. Anyway, one of the variations was to give people a little tiny pot of sweets. So you get a little leaflet, you know, and it's information about it when they come in. But in one variation, about 5% of people give. If you get a little tiny tub of sweets with it, it more than doubles the number of people who then give a day of their salary. It's a really valuable pot of sweets. Running it again next year, for people who had the sweets last year, it still works, but the effect size is halved. Whereas people who eat fresh, you know, don't. So you can see it's got novelty. It's making you do something in a way you might not have wanted. But otherwise, if it's something you want to do anyway, I'm going to give a very simple example of if you set your watch fast. A lot of people do. I mean, most people. I don't know how many people in the room set their watch fast? If you have a watch still, I do. And you think, That is a bit odd, isn't it? I mean, you do kind of know. And occasionally, if you're like me, you think, oh, you know, I just said it at the right time. And then you miss your train for the next 2 weeks. Because it's persistently effective, because it works under the circumstance it needs to, right? Because if you're not in a hurry, you make the mental adjustment. But if you're in a hurry, you don't. So, but it's kind of working with the grain, something you want to do anyway. So it's a key issue, and there's quite a lot of work on what is sustained and what's not. Well-being, life, yeah.
Yeah, individual life satisfaction, overall life satisfaction, I think.
Yeah, so, look, it's a very rich area. As you know, the PM has been interested in this. It's been quite a difficult agenda to pursue because you get laughed at, basically, like, what are you talking about and stuff. I personally think it is a very serious one around, I said, I could put it in terms of deshrouding. Amazingly, life satisfaction, since we've been measuring it, possibly by coincidence, I'm sure, but in the last 4 years, it's gone up the last 4 years in a row in the UK, although there's some evidence for increasing inequality. My basic argument is that Matthew and I have talked about this before, a famous example is commuting. People often think if they buy a bigger house for their kids and they live further out of London, they'll be happier. It turns out generally that's not true. You'll be less happy. And also your partner...
Has anyone just done that, by the way? I'm so sorry. All that stamp duty.
But the point about it is we are prone to some of these misconceptions. Or a very nice one, I don't know if you ever had her in, Liz Dunn, a beautiful paper with Mike Norton on, if money doesn't make you happy, you're not spending it right. because there are some things that you can buy. In fact, one of the most things you can do is give money away. It makes you much happier than people think it will make them. It feels really good to help someone else. But people systematically underestimate those effect sizes. So at the very least, do you want government really doing this all to you? No, but it is quite a profound agenda that when you go and buy a product or a thing or try and decide what to get your kids for Christmas, that you actually did it in a well-informed way. And it might turn out buying that big piece of plastic wasn't the best thing to do, whereas buying some tickets to go to watch a football match or something together would be much more effective. But we're often not very good at making those judgments. So again, it goes partly to me, even in markets, but also beyond markets and what we do in our relationships, is that for us to be able to be, make better judgments in our lives is quite a powerful idea.
The final one, you've got 1 minute, which is philosophically, what does this tell us ontologically about the human condition?
Well, there is one thing I often said about, psychologists, and it's important in terms of the impact on policy, is that... great, these psychologists have given us like 100-something theories. Couldn't they just give us one that worked? That would be better. Part of the problem is that the brain is much more complicated and messy than we think. So you have the illusion of unitary processes when you make decisions. That's not really there when you unpack it. Minsky years ago used this phrase about society of mind. Like, it's not just society out there, but you should use democratic processes to decide on important issues, like what's the right thing to do on obesity or whatever. But actually, there's a sort of democracy in your own head of rival processes that run it. And that makes it a bit more complicated and messy. But, the most basic thing, we as I said, use a simple framework sometimes, East, easy, attractive, social, timely. But that, human beings are quite a lot more complicated and wonderful in lots of ways, I think, in how we make decisions. There are some things we are very good at and there are some things we're very bad at. And we should at least try and decide and design policies and where we do through design elsewhere to help people around the things they do well, not around things that they don't do well.
So, thank you for that. One of the things we've found out over the years in surveying you is that one of the most important determinants of satisfaction with an event is that it ends on time. So, on that basis, I'm afraid, be taking more questions. There are lots of people wanting to ask more questions. I have a final question for you, David, which is, how much more likely is it that someone will buy a book if the author signs it? Have you done that work? Well, let's test it now, because it's a wonderful book, incredibly readable, full of rich examples that you've been hearing, and it's available outside, and David will sign it for you if you get a copy. It just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking David Halpin.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.